And we've also got, oh, there we are. We're sorry, we're missing a little bit of volume. You may have heard me whispering in the background, but we are here. This is the Green Majority. You're listening to Darren Kaster. We've got a few special things for you today. There we go. We can hear myself think. That's all right. So we've got a few fun things on for you today. I've got Kevin Farmer in the studio, which is always fun.
Hi, Darren.
Joining me for the whole program once again. It's nice to have a co-host. I don't feel so lonely here in the booth. So he'll be sitting here throughout the whole show, which means that, of course, the lovely Leah Mazzolini is sitting at the Twitter feed. So if you have any questions, comments, concerns today about any of the programming, you want to reach us live on air, you can of course send us anything you like at Twitter at Green Majority. Leah's sitting by the computer. You can also Facebook us, so we're interactive, live and interactive during the show here today. We've got a couple of fun features. First off, as any regular listener of the program knows, personal hero of mine, Carl Sagan. I never let you forget it because I say it just about every program. I think he's wonderful. So it's absolutely perfect that not only today, November 9th, happens to be Carl Sagan's birthday. Happy birthday, Carl Sagan. And also that we have Jay Ingram on the program. Jay Ingram is very much a spiritual protege, if you will, of Carl Sagan, a well-known science activist and he's from the Discovery Channel's Science Channel, made famous from the Daily Planet. He's also won the Order of Canada and is many honorary awards. He's run tons of books, both for adults and children, on the topic of science, and just an all-around swell guy. I remember watching him on TV when I was just a lad, and he's still putting out some great work. We speak to Jay Ingram in the first half of the program. Second half, we have Lillian Brumette, who is one of two hosts of the Conscious Discussions Talk Radio show. They do a wide variety of stuff, website design, all sorts of stuff. But mainly the thing we're talking to them about today was their Conscious Discussions Talk Radio show that they have, as well as some of the books that they've put out, Trash Talk and others, talking about just being an on-air personality, sort of a way of vicariously interviewing myself, I suppose, talking to another talk radio host talking about environmental issues and sustainability. So Lillian Brumette is in the second half. However, we're going to have a quick word with Kevin Farmer here before we go get into our first feature. Kevin, we recently had the conclusion of the U.S. elections. Barack Hussein Obama is still the president. What does this mean for the environment? I've got a couple of points, but I know that you had a couple of things here as well. What's your takeaway now that we have the conclusion of the U.S. elections?
Well, so Obama spoke passionately about embracing climate change and mitigation strategies as opposed to adaptation strategies, which is a good sign. It's at least the Republicans are still full of climate deniers, and I don't think we could have expected any action on climate change from a Romney administration. Obama at least embraces the idea. He at least pays it lip service. Whether or not we see any, whether or not we see any actual policy on this remains to be seen, because they're in the, they're facing huge economic crisis right now, and there's always that false dichotomy that action on the environment costs the economy, and I worry that he would be weak. In a vulnerable position if he were to pursue environmental policy in advance of sorting out their economic problems. I think just because of the misperception on people's minds that the climate and the environment and the economy are mutually exclusive choices. Excuse me.
One of the points that I picked out, I was watching all the election night coverage, stayed up late to make sure that we weren't in as bad trouble, i.e. Romney winning. But I think one of the interesting things about this being Obama's second term was that we were able to kind of see what sort of talking points during the election translated into what sort of action during a non-election cycle for him. He's an outstanding campaigner, which we've seen both two times now.
Right.
But we've also seen that he's a little bit loose on his commitments. And I think you used the absolute 100% perfect term there, lip service, because there was definitely references to the environment in his acceptance speech. But it was a lot of insinuation. You sort of had to read between the lines. It was a sort of speech that I felt where the right person was supposed to take the right message out of it, but he didn't actually say anything.
Right.
There's one in about Al Jazeera had it cut into two clips. So during the beginning of the second clip, so roughly off or halfway through the speech, he did something about and our commitment to future generations and all this stuff, and it really sort of seemed to be leaning on that, and we're going to do something about climate change, we're going to do something about the environment. But he didn't say the word climate change, he didn't say the word environment. He also said stuff about getting off of foreign oil, which could mean alternative energy, which could just mean drilling more at home.
Yeah.
So, it's really good sounding speech, really, really positive, uplifting feeling. I'm not holding my breath. I don't know about you.
Well, I'm curious to see now what happens with the Keystone XL pipeline. Environmentalists were, excuse me, sorry, I really seem to have a hoarse voice today. When Obama essentially scuttled the agreement earlier, it was seen, environmentalists were quick to hail this as a great victory for the environmental movement, but it wasn't actually. It was, Obama was merely punting the issue to a later date. He, you know, political strategists, the common wisdom at the time was that he didn't want to alienate the environmental bloc because he needed them for re-election. But again, with the enormous pressure to revive the economy and, with this, you know, really extravagant investment in infrastructure moving the pipeline and access to, oil, petroleum products from a politically stable country. You know, there's a lot there that would appeal to a pragmatist who's, you know, as I said, dealing with an economic crisis of sort of historic proportions.
Well, I want to make one final point before we move on to our music break and then get to our interview with Jay Ingram coming up after that music break, which is that I think there was something very notable in that speech as well, which there was got a lot of applause, very big reaction from the crowd during the acceptance speech. The celebration speech afterwards, which was the acknowledgement of the right of same-sex couples in the U.S., doesn't really have anything to do with reference to our program, except for the fact that whether or not he's going to do anything, he felt it was more politically viable for him to make a public announcement of his support for same-sex couples than it was for him to say anything specific about the environment, which I think that is maybe our take-home message about the position of the environment in American politics right now. Anyway, that's all we're going to have to say about that for now. We'll come back with some more news updates throughout the program. For now, we're going to have a quick music break. We'll be right back. So we are back. You are listening to The Green Majority. I'm Darren Kaster. We just had a little bit of a discussion about American politics, and the U.S. election, of course, was just concluded. I mentioned, as I'm going to mention a couple of times today, happy birthday to Carl Sagan. With that note, we're going to move on to someone very similar to Jay, to Carl Sagan, in my mind, at least, the Canadian version, if you will. Jay Ingram is a famous Canadian science broadcaster. In addition to being a recipient of the Order of Canada, he's also won a number of other honorary degrees. He's got a whole bunch of real degrees. He's written about 20 books, some for children, some for adults, and is also most famously the host of Canada's science show on the Discovery Network, Daily Planet, for 16 years. We go now to my conversation with Jay Ingram, talking about an article he wrote for Alternatives Journal on about why people believe what they believe on issues where science has a clear answer and not everybody agrees, having to do with their personal feelings and sort of where there's a correlation between people's mindset and the types of things the type of scientific issues which they accept or disregard. So we go now to that interview. So we're talking to Jay Ingram today. One of the things that we'd like to be speaking about is an article that was in Alternatives Journal. Friends over at Alternatives Journal once again have had a great article here by Jay. The article is called "Belief is Biased. It's Vital to Know How Our Values Trump Logic." Welcome to the Green Majority, Jay Ingram.
Thank you very much.
So one of the things that I really liked about this is you sort of get into one of my many favorite topics here, which is science activism. The gist of your article, if I understood it correctly, was that people's feelings about certain genuine scientific controversies, but in many cases kind of so-called, as you put it, scientific controversies, can be aligned with something that people don't generally think about too much, which is sort of their mindset, if you will. Do you want to maybe say it the way that you had it in the article there about what sort of people's beliefs almost define how they feel about certain issues?
Yeah, because, you know, I think that a lot of, certainly a lot of scientists, and additionally a lot of people who put their faith in scientific data, I'm one of those people, assume that when there's disagreement, when there's a significant part of the population that's disagreeing with them, let's say about climate change, that if only those people knew all the data, then they would agree. You know, because people who sort of base their arguments on data just assume that they've done it correctly. Well, the point is that people, at least when it comes to controversies, really don't spend much time thinking about data. They take sides in a controversy depending on other social and cultural issues. And the best research has been done by a group called Cultural Cognition, and their website is culturalcognition.net. And they argue that you can kind of, it's actually pretty easy to divide the population up into, on a couple of axes. One of them is people that are satisfied with a hierarchical society, you know, where some people rank higher than others. The opposite end of that axis would be people who are communitarian and, you know, like to see everybody get the same opportunities. It's also true that you could be an individualist or not, you know, a rugged individualist or not, or egalitarian. And so if you hold values, and we all do, somewhere on those two axes, that's going to really determine how you react to a controversy like climate change. So, for instance, climate change implies, let's say people were taking action seriously on it, it might introduce a carbon tax. And individualists who basically don't like taxes at all are going to find a way, and I think it's mostly unconsciously, they'll find a way to disbelieve that climate change is an important issue. So you see what I mean by not, they're not really looking at the data. They're looking at their own comfort level, their own lifestyle. They're looking at what threats to that lifestyle would be brought by taking climate change seriously. And then they're somehow deciding, and again, the really important point is that it's unconscious. They're not saying, well, I can't believe in that because it will harm my lifestyle. They just subtly find flaws in the arguments for climate change. And to me, that's the way the whole climate change debate has spun out so far.
One of the factors I'm really interested in here is, you know, I took my statistics classes in university, and so I'm used to seeing when you have a large enough population of pretty much everything working out to a stable bell curve, but you don't find a stable bell curve of people who, for instance, believe and disbelieve climate change is anthropogenically caused or a danger or any of those kind of attributes. Is there an equal distribution of people along these egalitarian versus hierarchical and communitarian versus individualist? Or is this, like, I guess what I'm really getting at is it nature versus nurture? Is this kind of, do you find that this is evenly spread, or do different areas tend to emphasize one more than the other?
No, I think it's probably within the entire population, those attributes are evenly spread. The thing is, when you get to a controversy, most of the voices you hear are not the voices in the middle who haven't made up their mind or who are easily or relatively easily swayed by new information, but the hard-held views at either end of the spectrum. So, yes, it's anthropogenic versus no, it's not. Those views tend to be adopted to a great degree by the social cultural values that the people at those ends hold. So I don't think it's anything, I think if you look at the best research has been done in the U.S. on the opinions people hold about climate change. And I think you can see if you look over the last 10 years or so that it kind of waxes and wanes. More Democrats believe in the seriousness of climate change and that we're responsible for it than do Republicans. But the numbers do move up and down. And in fact, it's probably silly just to break them up into two groups. There's probably 6 or 8 or 10 or something like that. But the really important thing is that if you're trying to sway somebody who's hanging on tight to denial of climate change, you have to understand that pouring more data onto their head is not going to change anything. At the extremes, it doesn't have much to do with data at all.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that when you're talking about people, you said there's a large amount of people in the middle who are more susceptible to being convinced by the data because they haven't maybe committed, personally for themselves, kind of psychologically, haven't committed to any of these ideas in an ideological sort of not necessarily rationally based decision-making point of view. When we're talking about that so-called mushy middle, as you put it in the article, are you aware of this changes from issue to issue? Like, would you find someone who's maybe, say for the sake of example, extremely, climate change is not anthropogenic, this is a natural system, but maybe on another issue like ocean acidification, that they're far more prone to science? Or does this kind of generally apply across the board to their beliefs?
I think the one thing that is consistent is people will react negatively to any idea that challenges their views and beliefs and values and the views, beliefs, and values of their group. We all kind of self-organize into tribes of one kind or another based on the things that we value and the, the values that we hold true. And so, for instance, let's say climate change, individualists or hierarchical people who have strong ties to industry or believe that industry is good for us will find climate change an unappealing idea. Anthropogenic climate change, about which we have to do something. And they'll seek, they'll just come out with all the arguments that we've already heard. But if the question was put, well, what about nuclear power? They're much more likely, that particular group is much more likely to be positive about the use of nuclear power. And ironically, we'll use the scientific arguments for nuclear safety in that case, where they will not use the scientific arguments for climate change in the other case. So I think I can't predict how they would stand on every issue. I think that climate change deniers might well be pro-genetically modified foods simply because they see it as a kind of industrially good, clever technology and so on. Tend to be more pro-tech, than anti-tech. So mm-hmm. One suggestion has been you could sway the climate change skeptics by talking about geoengineering. But I'm not sure that would work. I think they'd see through that pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. When you're having to do with any scientific issue, one thing we like talking about a lot on this program as well is scientific literacy. And you address that quite directly in the article, saying that there's an old argument that if people were more scientifically literate, that they would be able to or more inclined to deal with these sorts of issues. But you found that that's not the case.
No, it's definitely not the case. I've never been a big fan of the goal of increasing scientific literacy because I think it's pretty obvious that even if the general population were more scientifically literate, they would still disagree about any issue that has any scientific component in it. And the beautiful example in this case is there was a study done of the Tea Party in the U.S. and their reactions to climate change, but they divided up the people they were polling, who all of whom are Tea Party followers, into they sort of adjudicated how scientifically literate they were, and they found that the more scientifically literate Tea Party members were even stronger in their denial of climate change. The explanation might be that, remember, they have a mindset to begin with, and if they're more scientifically literate, they might be able to see some of the weaknesses. And let's face it, not everything about climate change is perfectly explained scientifically. They might be able to pick out those weaknesses and use them to bolster their already held argument. So scientific, you know, that's just a myth that if everybody becomes more literate, everyone will agree. And I mean, I've heard these arguments for 30 years practically. Mm-hmm. You know, if we're more scientifically literate, we will be a smarter nation when it comes to voting on big issues. Well, you know, it's just demonstrably not true. So, you know, while a lot of science journalists and scientists would like to think that people would pay more attention to them, and that they might pay more attention to them if they were scientifically literate, most of the other reasons for wanting that are just bogus.
Mm. Well, and I think another way to look at that point too would be that if that were true, then you'd sort of be able to reverse imply that nations with strong climate change policy or carbon policies put in place are more scientifically literate, which is clearly not the case. In fact, a lot of the time that seems to be where there's areas where you're in dealing with a smaller country that maybe doesn't have the best education system simply because of resources, they're just not a rich nation, is reacting quite strongly to climate changes because you don't need to be scientifically literate to notice that the water's running up your front door.
Yeah, exactly. And, it was amusing when Sandy struck that the first reference to climate change I saw was a piece in the National Post basically saying, watch out, all the climate change freaks are going to come out and claim there's a connection to Sandy. So, in fact, the opposition, at least as far as I could see, was as early off the mark as those people that I think took a little bit of time and finally said, look, this is a giant unusual storm. Why wouldn't this make sense to be one of the several manifestations of climate change?
Well, and I was just going to say, I think the best part about that too is that because he wasn't saying, you know, people have already done this. The National Post was predicting that.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're right. The Post is right out front on these issues. I can guarantee you that.
I was like, well, clearly you saw a connection, or at least some sort of connection, or you wouldn't have made that comment in the first place. So it's sort of amusing that I see a potential connection here, so I'm going to say that this is nonsense. But it was like, well, even you saw a potential connection here is kind of the point that I took from that.
Yeah, well, you know, the post, you know, there's it's a good repository for some of the completely over the edge climate deniers, but there are also some really good columnists in that paper. So I tend to swallow and read them all anyway, just to find out what they're talking about.
One of the other things I wanted to get into a little bit was just this. We've had a sort of as a running theme over the past few months. The picture on the Facebook page for the Green Majority for a while was "I stand behind Canada scientists" as part of the protest against the quote unquote war on science in Canada. I was wondering if you just have any comment on that issue with relation to your article.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what the connection would be to the article I wrote. I do think it's absolutely ridiculous that Canadian scientists can have their work published in an international peer-reviewed journal and then cannot speak about it to the press. Instead, they have to contact some media guy in Ottawa who then will vet the questions and, for all I know, issue the answers at the same time. It's just ridiculous, and there's no other word for it. And so, there was a recent publication on levels of toxins being found in the area of the oil sands, and the authors of the paper weren't allowed to talk about their paper. Well, you know, I mean, what more can I say than it's ridiculous?
You've received numerous awards, one of which, of course, is the Order of Canada, and almost every single one of your awards has been in the direction of science popularization. You've written many, many books, several of them targeted specifically at children. What role do you see science playing for the general population with issues, I mean, obviously in this context having to do with the environment, but in a general sense? You said you're not necessarily a huge advocate of science literacy being the solution to these problems, although clearly you're interested in scientific literacy. Where does that play in as far as, like, we have scientists, you know, science back in the old days used to only be for scientists, and then we had someone who is, I've said on the program almost every other episode, is a personal hero of mine, Carl Sagan. You're clearly following in that same mindset of sort of science activism, or science at least exciters, getting people interested in science. What role do you think that having a scientific understanding of the way the world works for the average person plays into their relationship to the environment?
Well, I think there's more than one reason, and I think one would be that if you familiarize yourself at least with how science works, that should facilitate critical thinking, or at least the ability to dissect what people are saying and, you know, take the things that have no basis and put them over on one side, and take the arguments that actually do have some scientific basis and therefore some data supporting them and put them on the other. But, you know, in a larger sense, I believe strongly that science is part of human culture, and it's one of our great achievements, along with music, art, and so on. And yet, you know, I've spent too much time in the company of people who actually wear it as a badge of honor not to know anything about science, or to laugh when somebody utters the words math or physics. And I just think that's ignorant. You know, it is one of the great accomplishments of humankind, science and indeed technology and engineering. One of my friends describes it as the greatest adventure story on earth, and it is. And to be ignorant of that, especially to be willfully ignorant of it, I think is silly. So I just hope that, especially, you know, I really want kids at least to get an idea that no, this isn't just something you take in school that's annoying and difficult. This is actually, your school courses might be annoying and difficult, but the fact is that science, as it sort of paints the picture of Earth and the universe and their histories, is one of the magnificent achievements of that we've come up with, and I just think it should have its place in the pantheon of other human achievements like that.
Absolutely. Well, I might even have to go on record here as going even stronger than you on that point, because I think, you know, I would agree with you on your point about it being kind of up there with art and culture and everything as far as the greatest of human accomplishments. But my point has always been, you know, if it wasn't for science, we very likely wouldn't be here to have art and culture and all these other things, because it's been ingenuity that's allowed us, you know, that was our evolutionary niche. That's what allowed human civilization to flourish and get past things like, you know, global disease and treating all these sorts of things. So, I mean, I would have to go ahead and put it in the forefront. But maybe that's just because I'm a huge
science nerd.
Well,
I can't disagree with that. There would be art of a limited nature, given that even the Neanderthals probably did body painting and music, but it certainly wouldn't be Beethoven symphonies played in Roy Thompson Hall, I can tell you that.
All right. Well, I'll concede that point then, at the very, very least. Jay Ingram, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the program today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Darrell.
All right, and we are back. Of course, I'm Darren Kaster, and you're listening to The Green Majority. If you're just tuning in, we were hearing from Jay Ingram, famous Canadian scientist and host of The Daily Planet. Kevin, we're going back to you for a moment here for a news item. One of the ones that grabbed my attention today was an article out of the Huffington Post talking about the explosion in Europe of cycling and how that's been leading to reduced congestion and pollution. Comments?
Oh, yeah. Well, Europe's always been, you know, much further ahead of, say, Toronto or Canada in general, or let's call it North America, in bicycles as a form of urban transportation. It's a, and you know, China used to be a sea of bicycles, and unfortunately China's industrializing along the Western model, and now people are switching to cars, and they're following the route of consumption and congestion. Whereas, you know, some countries in Europe are quite wisely pursuing bicycles. For me, you know, we live in an interesting time now when more than half the world's population lives in cities. And we haven't gotten over the idea of the personal vehicle as the model of transportation. And the world just can't support 10 billion people all driving their own car. And that's where we might expect human population to stabilize at by the middle of this century, is somewhere around 10 billion. We just can't all have cars, and we certainly can't fit them into the city. So, I mean, Toronto is just a mess right now. It's nothing but congestion day in and day out. And yet, you know, unfortunately, we've got a mayor who seems to think there's some kind of war on cars and is rabidly anti-bicycle. And you know, I've always said that there's as much use for cars in a city as there is for guns. We have about as much need for one as we do for the other, and we should be aggressively promoting bicycles as a form of transportation within the city core and public transit. You know, anything that gets a car off the road, even a hybrid, mind you, I'll take a hybrid off the road too, in favor of a bicycle.
Well, I'm going to jump on that bandwagon. I initially laughed as your comment is referencing it to guns as a bit of a throwaway, but after thinking about it for 2 seconds, I'm actually going to jump on that bandwagon too, because I don't know if this is specifically where you're going with it, but what I saw with what you're saying was the idea around having a gun in a city is you need to have the idea of you need to be able to protect yourself because all the criminals have guns. So it's this kind of, you know, arms race thing where everyone needs to have a gun. I can compare the same thing to a car now that I sort of thought about it for a moment. The only really reason you need a car is because everyone else is driving a car, and there's an expectation of being able to do certain things, whereas if everybody was riding bikes and we invested all this money in public transit, you could do all the same things you could do without a car with a well enough system in the same amount of time. But, you know, as soon as one guy has a car and he's flipping past everybody on the road, then everyone's got to have one. I think actually you may have hit on something interesting there.
Oh, there's a name for this. I wish I could remember the name for this. It's a principle in economics. I'll have to look this up and get back to you.
I'm thinking of Dr. Strangelove with the mineshaft gap. That's where you were going with that.
It's on the tip of my tongue, but it's about how a public good always gets degraded.
Of the commons?
The tragedy of the commons. Thank you. That's exactly what it is.
Was good for something.
Yeah, yeah. And that's an excellent principle. And when you've got, what you've got is, you know, this massive investment in infrastructure in roads for one consumer product, the personal vehicle. We've got this, you know, billions upon billions of dollars spent in infrastructure to sustain our addiction to personal vehicles. And it's a common good. And so everyone tries to exploit it. And the tragedy of the commons is that when everyone tries to exploit a common good, it eventually destroys the common good. And that's what we've done now with roads, is that we've clogged them silly with cars and they're becoming useless.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have at this point. We're going to move on. As usual, the news items we're discussing today will be posted on the website so you can have a look. We'll post a couple other ones as well. And then if you want the full stream, of course, you should add yourself to our Twitter, which is @GreenMajority, or you can join our Delicious feed, or you can add on the Facebook. Tons and tons of ways to interact with the show. Go ahead and check out the website as well, which is having new content added to it all the time. Of course, that's greenmajority.ca. We also want to take a point in every program to thank our nationwide syndication, of course, our community partners coast to coast. As always, thank you so much for tuning in. If you're listening to this over the internet and not on the local radio station, go ahead and do the community a favor. Spreading good environmental information is always helpful. So even if you happen to listen on a podcast, if they don't carry us on your local community station, go ahead, send them an email, phone call, bang on their front door and say that you should carry the Green Majority. Helps us, helps you, helps the environment. Absolutely. So let's move on now. However, we're going to take a really brief music break and then we're going to come back with our second interview. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
right, so we've got to hurry ourselves along a little bit. We're having so much fun today that we're starting to get ahead of ourselves on time there a little bit. So I'm going to introduce Lillian Bremett. She, of course, is the host of the Conscious Discussions Talk Radio show, and she's going to introduce herself here in a little bit in the beginning, so I'll just leave it at that. Take it away.
My name is Lillian Bremett. I'm a 43-year-old woman, married for 23 years now to a wonderful husband and co-writing individual, Dave Bremett, and we live in Creston, B.C., in the southwestern portion of B.C. there. So we live in a very environmentally friendly, very green living community with lots of artists and lakes and mountains, and it's just absolutely gorgeous here, which we are so happy to be here. We just love that environment and just love looking around and appreciating where we live now. It's just so beautiful here. I'm very passionate about making a difference, whether it's adopting animals, working with a local animal shelter, volunteering in some way, supporting nonprofits, interviewing people on our radio show, highlighting different topics on our blog. So for me, my big passion in life is to make a difference, to feel like my life has value. So I think everything that I do is really based around that, whether it's my hobbies like gardening or social interactions, the places I go to, the things that I do, and my work as well. It's all focused on that.
When we're talking about environmentalism and sustainability, there's sort of two groups of folks you might be trying to reach in different ways. And one of them would be the sort of person who's already interested in sustainability or the environment or helping others, and they're looking for information. The other group of people is maybe people who sort of maybe aren't convinced. Maybe they accidentally ended up on your website. Maybe somebody recommended it to them. Maybe they didn't think they were interested in environmentalism necessarily as a big topic, but a specific article or a specific discussion caught their attention, and they're maybe in more to be almost considered in the up for grabs, their hearts and minds that have yet to be won. Do you feel like the relationship between the different way in which you and your husband sort of deal with these topics and interact with people?
That's a very good question, and you're right. There are many different ways of thinking and feeling about environmental issues. Now, back in 1999, just to sort of give you some history here, back in 99, when I was first starting out as a professional writer, I had decided to write an article called Trash Talk. It ended up being a column that was published internationally for about 6 years, and then it developed into the book, and now the book series that you see now on our website. But originally, the concept that I had with the book started with a client that I had. I was self-employed. I was running a business. One of my clients was of the very upper class. And she was often complaining about how much things were costing and how there was a lot of employment issues in the city. And then she would also talk about how she was afraid to go to places like secondhand shops for Halloween costumes for her kids, or to go to the Bottle Depot, because she didn't want to be seen by other people. She thought that was sort of beneath her. People would see her differently because of her social standing, her financial background. And so that to her was a source of shame. She was sort of hiding it. She didn't want to be seen. And then we also had another encounter with this very same client who we were just starting up the blue box collection on the curbside in that particular city. And she was all of a sudden just had to be seen putting out this blue box because it was the in thing. And that encounter with that client was the real inspiration behind Trash Talk, because I saw a real need for re-educating people to see the value of these efforts. It wasn't the matter of the 10 cents that they're going to get from the tin can that they were recycling, but it was the residual effect of that. A lot of people I also ran into really felt powerless. They were overwhelmed by all kinds of negative information from the, traditional media that was telling them, the world is doomed and we can't do anything about it. And so they felt really helpless about it. Whereas the topics that we covered in this column about, you know, reuse and repurpose and recycling and other R's involved in the zero waste initiative, we were able to do this with a slant of saving money, creating jobs, and your life does have value. The smallest acts really do have value. So when we were covering any topic within that column, we made sure that it covered those kinds of things. So we would show how many jobs it was creating. We would show how much resources it was saving, how much energy and water was being saved by taking on that action. We would show them other aspects, such as how much money they could save around the house by reusing or repurposing this item. And in the end, it really ended up inspiring people. We were hearing from readers that were saying, you know what, I didn't realize that I could have this kind of impact. I didn't realize that I could save these hundreds and sometimes thousands of dollars by doing these really small things around my home or my office. And that was really encouraging, and that's why we put it into book format after the column was out for a while.
Can you say a little bit more about maybe the idea of environmentalism or doing eco-friendly things being popular or cool with people?
Well, you know, it's really become quite popular now that celebrities, people who are in the media a lot, now that they're getting on board with it, all of a sudden the average consumer, the average individual is going, wow, you know, I got to do that too, and that's really cool that this bag is made out of old seat belts and, you know, these kinds of things. So people are really getting on board. The fashion industry, you see it a lot in packaging. Manufacturers are really trying to show more how they're more sustainable. It's really happening, and I think we really have to thank consumers for that, because consumers are really the power behind that. Every dollar that we spend is a vote in that direction. And I think it's really important to highlight that, you know, millions of jobs are created through the recycling, the reuse, the repurpose industry, a lot more, and in the rot, you know, in the composting industry, a lot more than what's created in just sending something to the landfill. So I think that's something we really need to highlight as well, is that, you know, every time you're recycling something, every time you're participating in one of these various industries that divert waste from the landfill, you're helping to create jobs in your community and in your country, which I think is so important, you know, that we realize that we have the ability to create those jobs.
Can you maybe comment on the sorts of different aspects and different ways in which your guests have come to the issue in the environment and some of the common themes that people talk about when they come on your program?
We use the blog and the radio show in a couple of different ways, but generally speaking, they both reach out to a very conscious-minded audience, people who are really interested in feeding their minds with positive, inspirational, motivational information, and who are looking for ways that they can make small changes in their life that will bring value to them, whether it's to their pocketbook, to their personal feeling of value, of being of worth in their community, and other aspects as well. So we really focus on inspiring people and motivating people by sharing these stories, these ideas. Now, on the blog, what I do is I'd like to have a variety of topics there. It's a daily blog, by the way, so there's something new every single day going up there, and that's why we're able to have so much of a variety of content up there. So we'll do mini World of Writing interviews where we'll have people come in to talk about literacy or how authors are making a difference and other genres along that topic. And then we also we have people who write articles who are talking about green living, renewable power, a variety of different topics. And then we also offer inspirational news, things that are happening around the world that are really inspiring and show the the ingenuity of the human mind, the things that people are coming up with, the jobs, the businesses that they're creating with these very eco-friendly ideas. We highlight nonprofit organizations. We do a lot of different things on the blog itself. Now, the radio show, it airs 3 times a week. And we tend to have, there are several different segments there that we air. There are the positive news segments, the world of writing segments. We also have interview segments and others. Now, the interview segments are some of my favorite episodes because we have experts from all over the globe, you know, from Africa, Germany, Australia, the United States, Canada, everywhere, come on to the radio show, and they share their story about how they're making a difference, you know, what they did, the steps they took, the resources they're able to offer. And it's just absolutely amazing because the listeners can participate in the live chat room. They can call into the show. They can message us. They can listen to the archives even years later and get inspired by that information. And it's just, it's a phenomenal experience for me as a host. I would do it for free every single day if I had the time and the resources to. It's just it's a real pleasure for me to host and to play a role in some of those amazing conversations.
You used a lot of words there, like you know, inspiring and uplifting, and all these sorts of things. And it's something that that I think you'll agree with me. We sort of, as a group, have to admit it can be difficult to do at times. There tends to be more bad news than good, and it's something that we sort of joke about on our show a little bit. You know, we have our pundit Kevin Farmer. I jokingly and lovingly refer to him as Dr. Doom. You know, because it can be very difficult to get into these topics and not get bogged down in all the negatives. How do you in what way do you deal with the harsh realities of some of the causes for some of these other situations that then might lead to an inspiring conversation in an interview?
Okay, so instead of focusing on the negative aspects of any one issue, let's just say, for instance, we're talking about water here, water issues around the world. Now, one could focus on all kinds of things, the pollution, the depletion of water sources, the dwindling, melting ice and the smaller glaciers that we're having now and all the other issues that come with water and acid rain, what have you. But instead of focusing on the negative things, what we'll do is we'll highlight only the positive things about that. What are people doing about that issue? So we'll have someone come in to talk about how they are a part of a company that has compostable, you know, toilets that work with composting systems or waterless toilet systems or low water toilet systems or, you know, a variety of topics that we've had on that particular genre, including rain barrel, using rain barrels in your home and gray water systems and many other topics that we could focus on of proactive things. What are people doing to make a difference in that regard? There's also all kinds of water cleaning technologies and many other aspects of that, creating energy from water that flows, many other things. So we would focus on that as opposed to the negative things. And you're right, you know, I think that what happens is we get sort of stoned into apathy. You know, we're hit by all of this negative information kind of battering us into the point where we become numb to it. We hear it all the time on the radio or on the television or in the newspaper, and it just becomes something, it's like white noise to us. We just become numb to it. We don't react to it. We get in this form of apathy where we feel like even if we wanted to do something, it wouldn't matter. And so we try to combat that by showing that what people are doing out there, businesses, nonprofits, and individuals, what they're doing really is having an impact. And that inspires people when they feel that passion, that joy, that inspiration. They're motivated to do something about it. They're motivated to get involved or install one of these systems or, you know, change over their toilets to low flow or whatever. So it really does make a difference by showing people the positive aspect of things, the being more proactive in life.
As representatives of, you know, non-corporate media, but media nonetheless,
what is your, I guess, your opinion on how the mainstream media deals with an environment? Do you find that there's a huge disparity between the types of opinions and views and just awareness of the types of people that listen to your program and come on your show as guests versus the average population in Canada? Do you think that the people are largely informed as Canadians or not?
I think you're very spot on when you talk about traditional media out there who I think focus on sensationalism. So they're going to find the most shocking, the most upsetting news that they can, and that's what they're going to be bringing to you. They tend to ignore the good news. They tend to ignore the amazing things that are happening out there, the new technologies, the new inventions, the amazing nonprofits that are out there every day making a huge difference. But they don't want to hear that. They want something that's going to shock people into putting out that 50 cents or that dollar or whatever for their newspaper. That's much more important to them. So, traditional media doesn't tend to focus on that. And I think that's the importance of having alternative media out there, like yourself, like ourselves, to highlight these things, to let people know that there's a lot of stuff going on out there that's just fantastic. And I think that gives us more of a choice in our life, too. We're not being controlled by fear. We're not being ruled by our disgust or our fear or our shock. We're actually living a more passionate, a more controlled, a more deliberate life because, you know, all of a sudden we realize, hey, you know, where I spend my money really does make a difference. If I am able to spread the word about what this nonprofit is doing, then we're going to reach a wider audience and get more people involved. It sort of ripple effects from there. People just really jump on that. I've seen some amazing responses from our listeners and readers, and it's so encouraging. People who have never volunteered before will listen to our show and they'll be inspired to start volunteering or, you know, to start donating or to help spread the word or, you know, get involved in some way. And it's phenomenal that one small, you know, office like ours can have this kind of impact out there, reaching thousands and thousands of people every month and encouraging them to keep on doing the good things that they're doing and to get more involved and to help spread the word and what have you. I think we need more people out there who are doing these kinds of things, but at least there is an alternative for people. I think we have to really choose what we're feeding our minds with, too. You know, are we going to go ahead and allow our minds to be fed by these traditional media sources, or are we going to seek out alternative, more positive information?
Do you have a few words perhaps for longtime listeners of the Green Majority that are perhaps suckers for punishment and coming and listening to all the details of the breaking news here from CIUT in Toronto, for that audience, if you have any words of wisdom about ways to look for inspiration in your life? I mean, obviously you can listen to your show and check out your blog, but you know, some ways in which maybe we can try and put a more of a positive face on this while we're dealing with some incredibly challenging problems both here in Canada and as a human species?
Well, you know, as a human species, we are becoming ever more educated. And that comes in some ways with a price because we are aware. And with that awareness comes the responsibility to do something. So we can't just sit back and say, okay, well, we didn't know anything about that. We're ignorant of that. Therefore, we don't have a responsibility. We don't have to do anything about it. The world has changed, and we do have a responsibility, each and every one of us. You know, it's really up to us to decide what kind of impact we're going to have. And believe me, you are having an impact. It's just a matter of choosing what that impact is going to be, being more conscious of what that impact is going to be. So it can be with every dollar you spend. You can look at the things that you're passionate about and choose only those types of things that you're going to be supporting. It can come with media, people that you're paying attention to, people that you're listening to. And you really do have value as an individual. A lot of people don't realize the impact that they can have. I mean, you could recycle one tin can and you've just saved enough energy to power a television set for 4 hours. Like, you really can make a difference. You can have a huge impact on the environment if you choose to participate. And these programs are out there for you. I mean, if you look around your community, you're going to find all kinds of battery recycling places and used clothing and used furniture, and all different types of recycling is available out there. You know, your fluorescent light bulbs, you know, there's so many different things out there that now that we can recycle, and it's so easy to get involved. So we can stimulate the economy, we can create jobs, we can save money. There's so much that we can do just by participating in these programs. So, you know, you, the individual, you really do have an impact. You really are valuable. You really are needed.
So maybe we can agree today's lesson is a couple of things. One, vote with your dollars. Always stay informed, and don't be afraid to talk to your friends about things that are important about you, about sharing information. I think as you identified earlier, a lot of the time people make bad choices because they don't know what the right choice is. So don't be afraid to speak up. What do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a very good message. And choose what you're feeding your mind with and what you're sharing as well. So, you know, you could share some horrible thing that you just learned of, or you can choose to share information about something that's wonderful and creative and inspiring. So what is your ripple effect going to be?
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Jillian Burmett, who's the host and writer of the Conscious Discussions blog and Conscious Discussions talk radio show that is available on blogtalkradio.ca. You can also check out their website at www.burmett.ca. That's B-R-U-M-M-E-T.ca. Thank you so much for joining us today, Jillian.
Oh, thanks for having me. I really appreciate this.
That is all the time we have for today. I want to thank all my guests. Again, you can go and check out, and we're going to have links to the stories that we discussed today will be available on the website. So go to greenmajority.ca. Thanks again to our community partners in CIUT. Until next week, have a great week, and we'll talk to you then. See ya.